Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
The journalist Emma Green came to the University of Utah this past winter to explore how diversity initiatives on college campuses are changing in response to political pressure. And it made sense for her to come to Utah. Last year, of course, lawmakers passed a bill requiring state universities to eliminate diversity programs and terminology and offices. In her piece for The New Yorker, Green writes about visiting the university's student union building. It used to be home to many of these programs, and Green described the space as in transition. It really works, though, as a metaphor for this wider dismantling of diversity infrastructure all over the country. And the student who showed her around wanted to remain anonymous. She didn't want to attract the attention of immigration officials.
That, right off the bat, set the tone for the tour that I was about to get. The concern and the sense of recent events that were hanging over that space and the people who were there. The student walked me around and she showed me the offices that had been and the offices that now were. We went to one office that was on the first floor of the student union building, which had been called the Center for Equity and Student Belonging. Now it's basically a bunch of staff offices. She showed me where she used to sit with her friends, and they would all sit around and just sort of chit-chat and talk about student affairs stuff, their clubs, what they were working on, their schoolwork. And there used to be some beautiful artwork in that space. There was, for example, a piece that showed these women who each had their own legacy of activism. One was Angela Davis, who is the Marxist prison abolitionist. Another was this woman, Grace Lee Boggs, who was an Asian American Black Power activist. That artwork has all been taken down. And what used to be a cozy space is now kind of a renovation site. When I was there, at least, there were boxes, there were guys there constructing furniture. And for me, that felt like a clear indication that this space, which used to really be the home base for students, and particularly students who were from ethnic or identity-based organizations, that wasn't really a place for them anymore. We went upstairs after that, and we walked past what had been the LGBTQ Resource Center that's been replaced by a sort of catch-all cultural center called the Center for Community and Cultural Engagement. They do events for things like MLK Day, they're going to do for Pride Week, but it's become, I think, more generic. The student who I was with said that she doesn't really go there much, and she feels like it's sort of performative, that not talking about the adversity behind some of those events doesn't feel authentic to her. We made a final stop at the Center for Student Access and Resources. It used to be the Women's Center. Now it's this catch-all center for students to come and get information about their scholarships. They provide certain mental health services. And I was chatting with the director there, and she said that a student had observed to her that it kind of feels like a dentist's office. So everybody who was there, who I met, was really aware of the fact that these spaces, which had once been home for students and for staff, to create a real sense of identity and belonging, particularly along these lines of gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and race, that those have all been transformed. And what's left is something that feels a little generic. It doesn't feel like it has very much particularity to it. One of the reasons why I was drawn to the University of Utah is that it really shows that catch-22, which is, on the one hand, there are legislators, thinkers, activists, all sorts of people who have said DEI and the way that DEI manifests on campuses in Utah, but also all over the country, was ultimately divisive. It made students lean in too much to their differences, the things that divided them, and specifically into a left-wing view of the world. And it didn't do enough to serve students from lots of different kinds of backgrounds, backgrounds that might not fit into a particular political or ideological frame, and offer ways for students of those backgrounds to connect. So there's that pushback on the one hand, but the corrective to it, which in Utah has been legislation and now federally may look like crackdowns from the Trump administration or legislation, could be both, that pushback from a legal and political sense creates this reaction. It's a reaction of uncertainty on campuses. Certainly, that's what I found at the University of Utah. It's a reaction of fearfulness around litigation or political investigation. And so there's a sort of drawing into the lowest common denominator that we can find that won't be offensive, that won't raise any more political hackles or invite any more scrutiny, that will allow us to step out of this sense of pain that we've had of being under the microscope and being accused of being partisan and being accused of being divisive. Of course, that is not the same as the kind of robust vision that I talk to a lot of other people about that they hope campuses will be able to move towards, which is a vision where students can come to campus, they can be all of the things about themselves, including religious or conservative or rural, including left-wing or Black or Chicana or whatever it is, and that there will be spaces where students are taught to not only feel at home, but also connect with one another, to push past the sense of difference or division and make friendships and be in classrooms together and learn together and exchange ideas. That is the vision that some have and are advocating for, but it's a long way to get there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Emma Green about her story. It's about this moment of transition, a pivot away from the traditional DEI framework to something different. It's a model of pluralism that tries to get, as she puts it in her piece, a wildly diverse group of students to engage with people who think differently than they do. And bearing the brunt of all of this are university presidents. And Green says the last year and a half have been rough. She begins her story at the Penn Club in Midtown Manhattan. This was a few weeks after Donald Trump was elected, and some college presidents had all gathered to talk about what was happening on their campuses.
This was a moment where everyone knew what was coming. Everyone knew that higher ed was about to be in the crosshairs. And I had a series of really interesting conversations. You know, some of the presidents seemed like they were blowing off a little bit of steam. One of the Paul ones, Tanya Tetlow, who's the president of Fordham, said that she had spoken with another college president who confessed that they would lie in bed every morning wishing they had cancer instead of having to go into work. The rest of them were very much talking about this set of issues that have been so public over the last couple of years, having to quell protests, having to deal with these different constituencies on their campus that feel mutually antagonized, having in some cases been called before Congress, the sense of real political pushback and scrutiny on what they're doing, and undergirding all of that, this feeling that somehow they've failed. They know something is wrong in their houses. They know that there is too much political bias on campus. There isn't enough space for different viewpoints on campus. They know that students are not necessarily being pushed to go past their comfort zones and talk to people who have really different viewpoints than them and learn to deal with that and be in class with them and form those relationships. They know that there's something that needs to be fixed on their campuses. So I had these conversations with these presidents who in real time were processing both the election and everything that's been happening for the past couple of years. And one thing that I noticed was that a lot of them were eager to talk about these initiatives that they've rolled out prior to President Trump being reelected, even sometimes prior to October 7th and all of the unrest on campuses, to try to get kids to talk to each other, to get more of a sense of encounter across difference, and more of a sense that every kind of person No matter what you think or believe or where you come from or how you identify, they will be respected on campus, but also they will be expected not to retreat and shy away from things that are potentially offensive to them. So that's how I started on this journey.
Their mood, I think you describe it this way in the piece, shifting from introspection to just feeling panicked right now. And they're looking for that new model, as you say. They're looking for a new paradigm. And we'll get to the idea of pluralism, that kind of pluralism pivot that you describe in the piece. But before we get there, talk a little bit about the moment we're in now and what's motivating it. Because it seems like before Donald Trump became president, before they started really fretting about these ideas being imposed on them by state legislatures or by a new administration, they were already sort of wondering if a lot of the ideas behind DEI were really working. You want to talk a little bit about that?
You know, I think there's been a really interesting shift that's happened. And this happened before President Trump was reelected, which is we're approaching a moment where people who would fashion themselves as liberal or centrist were already kind of questioning what has become known as DEI, which, of course, DEI isn't just one thing. It's a bunch of different practices. It's a bunch of different bureaucracies. You know, different people would define it different ways ideologically. Yeah. But there was sort of this questioning of the way that identity has played a role on college campuses and how thoroughly campus culture is structured around sorting these kids into different identity groups and helping them to formalize that sense of identity and also lean into ideas in the classroom that cater to a particular understanding of the world. And what I have found interesting is that there isn't just the set of conservative critics, although obviously those are the people leading the charge, but there's really been a transformation in the center and even on the center left in thinking about how all of that has come to be and whether it's productive, whether the amount of money and administration on college campuses that goes into this kind of programming is actually accomplishing what college leaders had hoped it was accomplishing. Mm. And I think all of that uncertainty and that sense of introspective doubt has gotten only more urgent in this political environment that we're in, where there's so much fear around what the federal government is going to do to college campuses that are seen to be in excess on DEI and who are seen to not have, for example, anti-Semitism in check on their campuses.
But if you're not focusing on gender or identity politics, what else is there? I think that question probably comes up. I guess that's part of the question. Is that the core part of DEI, or is that the problem? It's been defined by being about identity politics and that it doesn't take in other kinds of inclusion, like conservatives, like people with religious beliefs. But it seems like the key issue that university presidents are trying to work out is something that you describe as being broader than that. This is how you put it in the piece. How do we get a wildly diverse group of students to engage with people who think differently than they do?
Yeah, I think that's right. There is a certain way in which in many places, although probably not everywhere, on the ground, the practical manifestations of DEI programs, meaning the offices, the scholarships, the cultural centers, the administrators, that whole ecosystem that exists on specific campuses and nationally has become narrowed or was always narrowly focused on very specific aspects of identity, aspects of identity which really matter, which is race, gender, sexuality, to a certain extent, disability. And this is in part an artifact of history. It's about the people who advocated for these programs and the things that they care about and the milieus that they came up in. It's about the intellectual disciplines of gender studies and racial and ethnic studies that help to form the thinking around how this kind of programming should work, or what would be the ideal form of college culture. And of course, the advocates of pluralism or advocates of a sort of wider frame point out, rightly, that those identity categories capture some people's core experiences as people, but there's something so much bigger. There are so many different categories of the way people think and the way that they believe and what defines them. And also, there's this perception, which I think probably everyone would say is at least a little bit true on most college campuses, which is that the identities themselves are twined with an assumption about ideology. It's assumed that if you're Black, you believe a certain thing, or assumed that if you're a religious Christian, that you believe a certain thing. And that, of course, isn't true. And so what I've heard is a hunger among college presidents, among others, for a way of framing the problem or the question of college campuses, which is bringing together lots and lots and lots of different kinds of people and helping them learn not only their academic studies, but learn how to live together as a core skill of being citizens. There's a hunger for a broader frame. There's a hunger to widen the aperture of how identity is thought about, how viewpoints are thought about, and to also bring in the question or the concept of resiliency, which is thinking about students' identities not primarily as adversities or things that oppress them or make it hard for them, which of course can be true, but also moving to this idea of you're resilient. You can encounter people who disagree with you. You can encounter people who, in some cases, disagree with you in a really fundamental way. And part of what it means to come to college and get a college education and hopefully graduate and become a productive citizen is learning to deal with that and be productive in that and hopefully build alliances across that.
You know, you could have tested this hypothesis in a lot of different places. Why did you choose Utah? One of the things you mention in the piece is you describe this state here as being, you know, deep red politically, but moderate temperamentally. Is that one of the reasons why you thought you wanted to see how it was playing out here?
Well, Utah is endlessly interesting. I think it's one of the most interesting states. So that's one of the reasons. There's a culture of Utah that is really distinctive and specific. I think the religious culture of the LDS Church creates a really distinct environment in Utah. Really, the reason I chose it was that there are a lot of states that have passed or considered legislation limiting DEI. Utah was one of the states that's passed the most comprehensive legislation, so touching the most aspects of campus life. And I also felt that it was a more nuanced or complex story potentially than we've heard in some other states, because I really got the sense that that distinct culture of Utah and that distinct political temperament really conditioned the conversation around DEI, around how campuses should change. And I always am attracted as a journalist to the most complicated versions of the story as opposed to the most predictable version of the story. So I came to Utah looking for nuance and complexity, and I think I found it.
Yeah, I think you did. I think it's interesting, too, the way you write about what seems to be this kind of shift that played out both in the state at large, like with state leadership, like Governor Spencer Cox, and the kind of Utah Compact and what we describe here as the Utah Way, a sort of more moderate approach, but also at the University of Utah, where you have, because you write about the history of the University of Utah being really proud of these progressive programs. There's that part, and then there's this kind of shift. And we can talk about the shift in a moment, but there is some nuance in the way the state has thought about this, at least before the Trump moment, I guess.
I think that's definitely right. Everyone I spoke with conveyed that the University of Utah is this sort of shining beacon in the state. It's an R1 university. It's sort of considered the top public university. And there's something in it, too, that is a little bit proudly apart from some of the other aspects of culture in the state and certainly in Salt Lake City. I heard over and over again from different people, not just people who are part of the LDS Church, but others as well, that there has historically been this tendency, because the University of Utah attracts national candidates for jobs because it's such a top university, that those who come from out of state and those who are pretty secular are a little bit, you know, not only leaning into their progressive identity, but pushing back against the religious culture of the state, punching up against the church, or what they perceive to be punching up against the church, because they have this sort of national perspective. So to me, it was really interesting to come to a place like Utah, which on the one hand has clearly, even at the University of Utah, such an ecosystem that's informed by the religious culture of the state and the particular identity of the state, but also that the University of Utah itself is a little bit of its own island, its own culture, and has this historic reputation of wanting to lean into a particular progressive vision. And I think that's been particularly true in the last, say, 10 or so years, as the administration has taken steps to create this sort of DEI, as they call it, EDI infrastructure that eventually, very recently, got dismantled.
Yeah. You write about how the university had always been proud of its progressive ideas related to these things, but then they kind of shift into a kind of overdrive in 2015. They create, for example, a new college, as you write about, the College for Cultural and Social Transformation. It's called Transform. And you talked to someone we know around here fairly well, Catherine Bond Stockton. She's a professor of English and critical theory at the U. She helped create Transform. And she's an interesting character because she seems to sort of characterize what's going on here, that kind of nuance here, because you describe her as a both and, you know, willing to engage with people who didn't agree with her, but also really intent on protesting if she needs to and protecting the students that she sees as vulnerable. She seemed like a good sort of symbol of what you were getting at the U in some way.
I agree. I think that she is the exact kind of person that a conservative who really doesn't like DEI would be eager to try to caricature or pigeonhole, because on paper, her academic background is exactly all the things that conservative opponents of DEI are always criticizing. You know, she talks about critical theory. That's one of her areas of expertise. She's focused on the experience of African Americans in the United States in literature in her classes. She is someone who thinks a lot about gender and sexuality. And of course, she helped to build the EDI, as they call it at the U, infrastructure, and was one of the people who created this whole new school, which one professor described to me as the Left Humanities College. But I found her to be a really complicated person. She was really attentive to the beauty of encountering students of lots of different backgrounds. She spoke about coming to the U in the 80s and just loving encountering LDS students because she felt really tenderly towards them. She felt like she could really understand where they were coming from. She loved having conversations with them. And she has modeled in her life, in her academic life, wanting to encounter and seek out conversations with people who do not share her worldview. And that, in some ways, is exactly what advocates of pluralism want. But on the other hand, she does subscribe to some of the ideas, or did take pains to emphasize some of the ideas that I have found are common in DEI spaces, which is this idea that not everyone should be asked to, or be forced to, or be expected to encounter people who are really different from them and ideas that are really offensive to them because it might hurt them. It's this sense of protection, the sense that students are vulnerable, the sense that the real need for that EDI style infrastructure is to protect students, to help them overcome adversity because they have faced so much adversity based on their identity, and to protect them from further harm. So, you know, it's a both and. There is a tension between this idea that the point of college is to protect students and help them overcome adversity and help them move forward to get their degree, versus the point of college being to bring students in and hopefully toughen them up to go out into the world where they're going to have to meet lots of people who disagree with them and don't like them and have offensive viewpoints. And they're going to have to be able to deal with that, not only as people who have jobs and have families and go to schools, but also as citizens, that that's a core component of citizenship.
You write about the way, whether it was intended or not, sort of the consequences of this DEI, EDI, in the case of the University of Utah program, that it became a kind of a siloed ecosystem where you had the most progressive professors teaching to the most progressive students. And then also this idea that, according to one of the former vice president for EDI, she told you that the university seemed to be most responsive to students and staff who were seeking out conflict and pushing demands. Do you want to say something about what's happening here?
Yeah. So the person who you're speaking about is a former vice president of Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion, whose name is Mary Ann Villarreal, and she came to the university in 2019, and she's a longtime scholar and person who's worked on campuses in this kind of space, in diversity and equity work and inclusion work. And she observed pretty quickly that the culture on campus was reactive. It was students protest, and then the university administrators give them something that they want. That students find that their only way of engaging with the administration or engaging with the university is through this sense that they're pushing back against something, that they're fighting. Mm. You know, she told me that when she arrived, she basically had a list of demands on her desk within the first 24 hours. That was just the status quo. And what was so interesting to me about her is that she described trying to build an apparatus that was proactive. So instead of waiting for there to be conflict and protest and for the students to get really mad and the administrators to be in a tough spot and have to figure out what they're going to do, you build the center that works for the students. You build a Black cultural center that students actually want to go to. You create a sense of connection for students who are from rural backgrounds, who maybe haven't been served previously by student affairs or by the DEI/EDI infrastructure at the U. She wanted there to be less of the sense of antagonism around identity. And I think in that, she was really seeing something that a lot of college presidents who I spoke to for this piece have observed, which is they all believe in protest. They all believe in the First Amendment. They all believe in the right to assemble, of course, and to speak freely. And they really value that. And I think all of them recognize the limits of protest as the only means of creating culture on a campus. If protest drives your campus culture and sets the tone, that itself can erode that sense of community fabric. So it's not that protest is bad. It's that having only protests as the engine of change is ultimately fatiguing, and it unravels that sense of campus fabric.
There's another part that is, well, it's ironic in a predominantly Mormon state that you have cultural centers at the major university leaving out the needs of Latter-day Saint students. You talked to Eboo Patel, founder and president of this group, Interfaith America, and he talked about the University of Utah's rank and file seeming, as he put it, I'm reading this from your piece, they seemed enthusiastic about racial diversity and gender diversity and cultural diversity, but not religious diversity. So that Mormon dynamic is really interesting here.
Yeah. You know, he really emphasized that he didn't find this among the top leaders at the U. It was more the sort of everyday staff that where he found this attitude. And this was his observation and his finding. But you know, he talked about, for example, being in a room with a bunch of staffers and asking them to share about a time when religion had helped a student or been an advantage to a student who was going through a tough time. And he told me that it was like 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds. Nobody had an answer, or nobody was willing to share their answer in front of their colleagues. And to him, that stood out because it showed that religion wasn't seen as something that can be a wonderful thing in a kid's life or help them to get through a tough time or help them to connect with family or with peers, it was seen as something that is sort of a system of oppression or as being principally, as he described it, anti-LGBT. That's the perception that he described. So there is this tension here, which is on the one hand, the University of Utah has a sizable LDS population. And obviously the surrounding area of Salt Lake and the surrounding environment of Utah is very much LDS. But I don't know that, at least in Ibu's experience and perhaps others on campus, other people I spoke to, that some of the folks who were running the day-to-day life of the university, that they thought that those students were the ones most in need of an infrastructure of services that could help them to navigate campus life.
Emma Green, she's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article is called What Comes After DEI? It's in the April 21st edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Emma Green's new piece in The New Yorker. Green wanted to explore the unraveling of diversity initiatives on college campuses, and she came here to the University of Utah. DEI offices have been emptied and repurposed, and Green captures this moment of transition and reflection in higher education. It's a reshifting of university culture that includes a broader sense of inclusion. Let's come back to the idea of pluralism itself, the concept, this new paradigm that universities like the University of Utah are thinking about or are adopting. Where does it come from? Tell us about Danielle Allen. She seems to be, I don't know if it's her idea entirely, but she certainly is one who's making the argument and developing the concept.
Yeah, Danielle Allen is this scholar at Harvard, and I would say that she is one of the core intellectual driving forces behind this particular pluralism movement. And what that movement is for is a set of people who work on campuses, who are scholars, who are thinkers, who work with students, who run clubs, who run organizations like Eboo Patel's organization, who are all advocating for this idea that identities matter, but all identities matter, that you can't just narrow identity to questions of race, ethnicity, gender, sexuality, and disability, that you have to have this broader frame. And that if you care about academic freedom on your campus and care about actually advancing your pursuit of truth, that valuing these identities and these different voices is critical because all of those different voices, the clash of those, the debate of those, the confronting of different ideas, the challenging of mainstream orthodoxy by minority viewpoints or people with a minority understanding of an issue, that's actually how knowledge is created. That's how you achieve excellence, is how she described it to me. And she has written a lot about this work. She's spoken a lot about this work. And there's a whole ecosystem of people who are also trying to build up the capacity of universities to engage in that way, to engage with that frame, whether it's people who are doing trainings on campus about dialogue across difference. There's a student network of clubs where students try to host debates or conversations about contentious topics called Bridge USA. I even saw it, for example, in some of the admissions questions that have been popping up in the last year or two. For example, NYU, their set of admissions questions was all about being bridge builders, right? It's not about, tell me about a moment that you have overcome adversity or about your identity being important. It's how have you built a bridge to someone who's unlike you? So there's this whole ecosystem that has emerged and is emerging. And Danielle Allen, I would say, is one of the intellectuals that's at the center of it.
But these ideas aren't just performative. They're not just workarounds, ways of skirting the now dicey political and legal questions related to DEI. I mean, they came before all of that, I guess, or around that time.
No, the movement for pluralism in its current form, it has existed for a while. And pluralism as an idea is really old. This is a horse.
Right.
But, you know, this current movement and this ecosystem has been developing for quite some time. And I would say the people who are advocates for that point of view, advocates for that approach to campus culture, they're really in a bind politically in this moment. And several people spoke to me about this. There's a real anxiety from both sides that they will be perceived by people who are on campuses, the faculty, staff, and students, especially those who are more lefty. They will be perceived as sort of, you know, the accommodators of the regime, that they're, you know, bringing out the tools of capitulation. And they're also worried that they will be viewed by the right, by conservative critics of DEI, as being a just kind of rebranded, relabeled, repackaged version of DEI. It's just DEI 2.0. All of them took pains to try to argue about why they weren't those things, why this is a real set of distinct ideas and approaches that are not just a recapitulation of DEI, but that also aren't just a form of accommodation to political backlash. And it's not just a form of insulation. On the other hand, you know, I had this very interesting conversation with Michael Roth, who's the president of Wesleyan University. And I just asked him point blank, are these enthusiasts around pluralism and viewpoint diversity, are they doing it, these college presidents, are they doing it because they're really scared that they're going to get sued? And he laughed and he said, yeah, sure, of course. Like, you know, everyone.
He said 100%.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Because, you know, anyone who is awake and observing the scene in higher ed understands that this is a moment of tremendous precarity for college presidents. And they all understand that whatever they are embracing, whatever viewpoints they're taking, whatever letters they're sending to their community, it comes fraught with danger, both of political backlash and of legal backlash, that they might, you know, be sued. And so, of course, that's motivating some of this. It's all mixed in together. But those who really are advocating for this set of ideas, like a Daniel Allen, for example, or an Eboo Patel, they really are keen to try to make the argument on the merits rather than the argument for insulation, for protecting yourself, because they ultimately believe that this is a better way to do campus culture, to do academic life, and to try to pursue excellence.
Mm. Of course, this law comes in Utah last year. Lawmakers banned DEI trainings and offices, prohibited universities from promoting some of these ideas about systemic racism. And you say in the piece that so much of the debate about that, you know, that particular piece of legislation, but also in general about DEI and free expression, you say a lot of this is largely about language. Explain what you mean.
So one of the things that I observed both in talking to the legislators who put together HB 261 and also in speaking to the leaders on the University of Utah's campus is that a lot of the conversation focused on the words that were being used to describe offices, positions, scholarships, initiatives, and also about the sets of ideas that were being either proffered explicitly or implicitly woven through that programming. So, for example, in HB 261, there was this idea that, you know, some of the programs on campuses had taught students that they were a victim or that they were inherently oppressors because of their sense of identity. It banned those things. It was sort of attentive to the way that language was being used to describe identity, to maybe lock people in boxes around identity. And similarly, I found that at the U, a lot of the reaction, a lot of how they tried to manage the fallout from HB 261 and the guidance that came down from USHU, which is the sort of board that oversees the higher education institutions, was basically trying to manage their language. So, you know, there's one set of instructions, for example, a guidance document that I found that reminded me a little bit of the board game Taboo, which is that board game there is a word that you are supposed to be describing to people, but you can't actually say the word itself. So, for example, they scripted an interview question where you're not supposed to talk about working with a diverse team. You're supposed to talk about working with people from backgrounds that are different from your own, which, of course, a synonym for that is diverse. So to me, it was really interesting to reflect on the role that language and language policing is playing here, because clearly so many of the words that have been used by colleges about diversity and equity and inclusion and all of these different things, belonging, they've become loaded. They've become sort of associated with a set of ideas and ideologies in, you know, conservative critics' minds, a narrowness, a limitedness around who they're supposed to benefit and the ideas that they're allowing. And that language policing, to me, feels really, really significant.
Emma Green, her article for The New Yorker is called What Comes After DEI. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the journalist Emma Green. We're talking about her new piece in The New Yorker. She came to the University of Utah to see what happens when diversity programs are taken down. And the piece is about this new phase in higher education, how a different model of pluralism is replacing the traditional DEI framework. I want to come back to the sort of the, I guess, the religious dimension, at least how it plays out here in Utah, at the University of Utah anyway. You mentioned some of the University of Utah's efforts at sort of being centered on religious inclusion. You went to the LDS Church's Institute, which is across the street from the University of Utah. What did you make of that place?
I thought it was really interesting. It was fascinating. I showed up, I actually went twice. I got a tour in the morning and then I came back in the evening when it was bopping and full of students. It's huge. It's got multiple basketball courts. They've got seating area with lots of couches. They have classroom areas for students who come to take religious classes, which is the main function of the Institute, is to offer religious instructions for students. It was really buzzing. It was very alive. There was some sort of dodgeball tournament going on that I didn't want to have any part of, so that they might get ahead with the dodgeball. And all of these students hanging around, they had had a panel earlier in the evening where the LDS students had met with students from InterVarsity, which is an evangelical campus organization, and they did an interfaith dialogue with one another. So it was a really interesting and rich ecosystem. And it also was so striking in coming off of all these conversations about the cultural and ethnic identity centers, identity-based centers that had been dismantled at the U, because those had basically been shut down because they were seen by the legislature and more specifically by UCI as being prohibited under this law, as being divisive and not constructive. And yet there was this example right next door to the campus of a privately run institution that was for University of Utah students to come together around identity, for them to all be able to make friendships and build relationships and feel at home and feel safe because they all shared in common a set of beliefs and who they were. And I reflected a lot on that because I think there's a real debate here. There's a real question here of what aspects of identity should offer this kind of salve to students, whether there's a difference between leaning into your religious identity as a set of beliefs and values that guide your life, as a way of building your relationships and sort of building your community on a big campus like the U. Or, you know, is that really different from, for example, building your identity and your sense of connection around being Asian American or being Pacific Islander? Is there something that's fundamentally different about those kinds of identity? And is it good to have those places where students can go and really lean into their particularity? What kinds of particularity are good? You know, I think it's an open question of what universities are going to lean into now that they're struggling with the sense of political pushback and potentially these new paradigms.
What do you think this paradigm of pluralism is going to mean? Let's say more and more universities adopt this paradigm. You mentioned a couple of other places where it's being done. Boise State, for example, William and Mary, a couple of other places. How do you think that new paradigm of pluralism is going to change the experience of being on campus and the culture of a university? Is it going to alter it dramatically?
It's a great question, because to answer that question, you have to think about the tools that a university has to create culture, an academic culture, a campus community culture. And the tools that they have are fundamentally culture setting, right? So presidents who make statements, faculty who set norms in classrooms, staff who share a certain set of values. And they also have tools of bureaucracy and infrastructure. So creating certain spaces for students to meet, making mandatory requirements for example, incoming students to read certain books and talk about certain things, to do certain types of programming and have certain types of speakers, right? So one question I would have is, how powerful are universities? How much power do they actually have to change the culture wholesale on their campuses to make students believe that it is important and good to encounter people who are different from them and to really confront head on in a constructive and respectful way ideas that they hate and that they really find detestable, right? So that's one question I have. But I would say the second possibility is, it may be that as universities lean into this paradigm and embrace all of those different kinds of tools that I was just speaking about, that they're able to reach and lift up a portion of the student body that I think already exists on a lot of these campuses. That's something I also heard over and over again. The sort of bridge builders who already are there, the students who actually already really want to go to a class that's about the history of conservative thought because they grew up in a really liberal place and have never actually had to seriously encounter those ideas before. The students who want to be part of a club where you're going to go and talk about really controversial topics of the day because they want to engage with those. That student population, I think, already exists. I think the question is whether that culture can be cultivated through some of these tools and whether also this is something that faculty, staff, and students are going to get on board with and go along with. There's a long distance between the college president and all of those other constituencies on a campus. And I don't know that in this moment, especially politically, that it's so easy to convince students, faculty, and staff that the number one thing they should be doing is talking to people that they really disagree with. That's just a horrible idea right now. So I think there's a lot of open question about what this would look like, what it can look like, and how much power people like college presidents really have to enact this.
And then ultimately, will a paradigm that you describe as pluralistic, will it satisfy the Trump administration? Will it satisfy critical conservatives? Because one of the questions, I mean, you mentioned the piece that the intellectual framework of pluralism seems like it's sort of legally sturdier than DEI might be, but will pluralism, as you put it in the piece, eventually go the same way as DEI? That is, it becomes a target for lawsuits and this culture war backlash. So what do you think?
I do not know. I try to not be in the crystal ball business because I'm a journalist, that's really an opportunity for failure. But I think it's a really big and interesting question. And here's why. I have spent a lot of time, not just in reporting this piece, talking to people who have lots of different viewpoints on DEI, our identity moment, and sort of where things stand in the culture in terms of how we think about identity. And there are a lot of conservatives who, whether or not they would use the word pluralism, are fundamentally bought into that frame, meaning what they want is for college campuses and, for that matter, American culture to value people of different viewpoints, respectful disagreement, that there's a place for conservatives and conservative thought and religious people and religious thought, that there can be that sort of liberal society, little L, ideal of the marketplace of ideas and people getting together and exchanging their ideas respectfully. There are a lot of people on the right who really believe in that and really value that and just want a little bit more intellectual diversity on campuses and think that, you know, the excesses of the university are very clear and obvious, but if you could just go back to some version of that, that it would satisfy them. I don't know if that is true of the Trump administration and the people who are cracking down on universities. I don't know if that will satisfy their goals. You know, I think a lot would depend on implementation. And I think a lot depends on the kind of relationship building and jockeying that's clearly going on behind the scenes as these different universities try to negotiate with the Trump administration. There's a certain way in which DEI and the excesses of the university, it's not actually a concrete problem to be fixed. It's a sort of political cudgel right now. It's a political football, right? It's a set of ideas that can get kicked around in the public sphere and you score political points off of them. So I think it really is an open question. I think it remains to be seen. And that's not to say that I don't think that people in the Trump administration may be operating in good faith to try to change what they see as the status quo on campuses. I think that very well may be true. So, you know, we'll see. Open question. But I'll let you know when my crystal ball spits out something for sure.
Emma Green, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emma Green, she's a staff writer for The New Yorker. Her article is What Comes After DEI. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. Or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.